He is a lifelong resident of New York City and a victim of police brutality. The experience motivated him to a career in law enforcement and an extraordinary journey beyond. He began as a transit cop and then a police officer who retired after 20 years at the rank of captain of the NYPD. He entered politics in 2006, where he was elected to the New York State Senate and served in the State Senate for 6 years, which, by the way, is where I first met him as an early supporter of Barack Obama in 2007. In 2013, he was elected Brooklyn Borough President. And in 2021, he was elected the 110th mayor of the city of New York, which, in my judgment, is the second most demanding elected position in the United States. Mayor Eric Adams, welcome to WBGO, and thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. And I just have to disagree with you on one area. It is not the second most difficult, challenging, I should say. It's the first, you know.
Okay.
I was looking at that little miniseries on Madam Secretary, which I just enjoy, and how she navigates the constant new challenges globally. If you were to take that and multiply it by 10, you get the starting point of what it's like being the mayor of the city of New York.
politics is local, and you matter much more to the daily lives of New Yorkers than a secretary of state, a secretary of Homeland Security, or even a president. Mr. Mayor, I do want to note that this interview was recorded on October 30, 2023. It will air a few weeks from now, just for full disclosure, in case there's some major local or national event between now and the time it airs. This interview is pre-taped on October 30. Before I ask you about your role and responsibility as mayor, I noted from your Wikipedia that when you were 8 years old, you moved from Brooklyn to Southeast Queens in 1968. I myself started off life on 114th and Northern Boulevard in Dory Miller Apartments. What part of Southeast Queens were you raised in?
We were in that no man's land between St. Albans and South Jamaica. You know, you were not south enough to be called South Jamaica, and you were not north enough to be called St. Albans. So I had an identity crisis of a neighborhood. And from time to time, we would say St. Albans. Another time, we would say South Jamaica.
Depending on who you're talking to, probably, right?
Yes.
Were you an athlete in high school?
I played a few games of JV, junior varsity, but I always played street sports, everything from playing football in the street to stickball, to playing baseball. You know, we were seasonal. Wintertime, we would play football. Summertime, we would play basketball and baseball. And never extended outside of those games. You know, never introduced to tennis or hockey or soccer. It wasn't popular back then. The one time I went to a hockey game at Madison Square Garden, it changed my whole perspective, not only on the game, but just really on life itself. And I really enjoyed it, and I became a hockey fan after that.
How did the experience of watching a hockey game change your perspective on life itself?
It was a friend of mine, David Sarasky was his name, and he stayed with my family because his house had a fire. He asked me that I wanted to go to Madison Square Garden. I thought I was going to see the Knicks. Turned around, I was going to a hockey game, and I was sort of pissed off because it was like, you know, back then, Black folks didn't watch hockey, and I was like, why are you bringing me here? And the game played and started, and the excitement, I realized that there was no rule that said Black folks couldn't watch hockey. I put that rule in my head, and when I walked out of that garden that day, I walked out with the full understanding that I'm not going to live by anyone else's rule, or I'm not going to create barriers in my head. It was a hockey moment for me, and my life has been filled with hockey moments of not doing what people expect for me to do, but carve out my own pathway.
Very interesting. Mr. Mayor, as you sit in City Hall today, what are the current challenges that you face as the mayor of the city of New York, and how are you addressing them?
Many of them. And I think the best way to define them is to go back to January 1st, 2022. We were dealing with COVID-19. People were afraid to leave their homes. Many people were afraid to come back on the subway system, not only because of contamination, but it was a public safety issue around those who were dealing with severe mental health illness, as well as people who were participating in criminality or tourism. We were hurting in many areas. We were dealing with some real economic challenges that we were facing. Crime was surging in the wrong direction, homicide, shootings. This city was in a very simple term, it was a mess. And those challenges we had to face head on. And when you do an analysis of where we are now, 22 months later, it's just remarkable. People thought it was going to take 4 to 5 years before we were able to turn around the city. And we did just the opposite. As you know, we cycle out of COVID. Schools remained open. Children was continues to be educated. We have more jobs now, 4.7 million jobs, more than the population of Los Angeles. Think about that for a moment. We have the highest number of jobs in New York City history. Homicides have decreased. Shootings have decreased. 5 of the 7 major crime categories have decreased. We have a double A bond rating from the bond raters. It's saying that this city is moving forward. So the challenges that we have faced, we have navigated through them. But the number one challenge that we are facing right now is the migrant and asylum seekers. It can undermine all of our success if we don't get the help that we need and if we don't look at some of the procedures that have been put in place for a non-traditional crisis that we're facing now.
I've been stunned by the cost of housing some 120,000, 150,000 migrants. It is the equivalent of having the city of Albany, New York, all of a sudden show up on your doorstep in need of housing, in need of a job. And it's blowing a hole in your budget, Mr. Mayor, obviously. So how are you compensating for this very unanticipated crisis?
And you said something that's very important, because it's not that America can't absorb large volumes of people, although this is probably one of the greatest shifts in human movement in this hemisphere in a long time, since this has really been fed by what's taking place in Venezuela. But it's not that managing large volumes of people. We did it during the early days when over 1 million people came through Ellis Island and absorbed into our city and our country. The problem is that that population equivalent to Albany not only showed up at our door looking for housing and a job, we are saying on the federal level, they can't work. That is the real crisis that we're facing. You have over 130,000 people who stated they want to come here and participate in the American dream, not to take away from the American society or New York City, but to contribute, and we're not allowing them to do so. And so instead, cities like Chicago, Los Angeles, New York City, Houston, we are now having to take upon the responsibility of feeding, clothing, housing, washing clothes, educating children. That responsibility cannot fall on cities. And it's going to have a $5 billion hole in our budget this fiscal year and over 3 years of $12 billion, just if the numbers stay steady. That's the crisis that we are facing right now.
And I know you've been engaging the president and others in Washington for help with this. It is the case that immigration policy and enforcement is supposed to be the role of the federal government. The problem is when you have a hemispheric shift like the one we're seeing right now, and over 100,000 people show up on your doorstep, you're going to need help from the federal government to deal with this issue. Mr. Mayor, I know you traveled to Mexico and Central America recently. I know part of your message when you were there was, don't come. There's a lawful way and an unlawful way to come to the United States. But what impressed you the most about that trip you made?
There were three goals. And, you know, there were attempts by others to misidentify what the goals were. Earlier last year, sometime, I went down to El Paso to see what was happening at our borders. And I wanted to follow up by going to the source of the problem. And I had three goals. Number one, to communicate with my local electeds and the governmental leaders in the countries of Colombia, Ecuador, and Mexico. And I was able to meet with governmental officials there, to get the scope of what was causing this migration here to New York City and to America. The second was to get on the local stations using radio, television, newspapers, to say to the people of those countries that all of the propaganda, all of the smugglers, all the individuals who were putting out Facebook posts that you should come to New York, you automatically are going to find a job and housing. I wanted to give a clear message firsthand from the mayor of the city that that's not the reality. And we believe we were successful in doing that. And thirdly, I wanted to go down and see for myself, particularly at the Darien Gap, to see what was happening coming through out of Panama, coming out of Venezuela, going into Colombia. And I wanted to see what the flow and understand what the volumes and what were some of their ideas to slow it down. So it was an extremely four-day trip that I thought reached our targets and allowed us to come back and do a real analysis of what can we do both locally, because we have the responsibility of locally, but what can we do nationally and what can we do internationally? Immediately upon coming back, I had a meeting with former President Bill Clinton, who was part of the Colombia plan that dealt with the narcotics issue that was flooding our streets. He knew he had to go through the source, and I wanted to get his feedback on how do we deal with the source, particularly in Colombia, who wants to be a real partner for us in this situation.
Well, you touched on something that I learned from my experience enforcing the immigration laws for 3 years. There's no level of defense we can put up on our southern border to overwhelm the push factors in that region of the world. The famine, the corruption, the drought, poverty, the violence, the gang violence that is motivating families to make the choice to come to the United States has to be addressed. You have to address this problem. I believe we can have another Plan Colombia, and Central America is a far more discreet place. So it's up to policymakers in Washington to have a sustained focus on doing just that. And I know President Biden believes it because he and I discussed it when he was vice president and I was secretary. Do you see light at the end of this tunnel, or is it getting worse?
And that's a great question you're asking. And I think with your experience of being in D.C., particularly in Homeland Security, you probably have an extra appreciation for the moment that we're in. I think that it depends on the actions that we take is going to make a determination. Is this going to overwhelm our large cities? We're talking about the largest cities in America, Chicago, New York, Houston, and Los Angeles. And if we don't take the proper actions now, I think it will have a long-term impact, and we can't have a policy of ignoring it. And you're right. I don't think you can merely put up a wall and expect the urgency of feeling as though America in general, but specifically New York, is your way out for your family. I am clear that if you're going to take that dangerous track through the Darien Gap, where you're likely to be harmed in some way, there is a real drive to get here to America. And we need to see, how do we slow down that trek by assisting Colombia, dealing with the crime problem in Ecuador, and creating a real partnership of applying in place in Mexico and some of these other some of these other countries. And that is how we have to do it. If we don't do a decompression strategy at our borders, that we can go to the over 108,000 cities, states, and villages and towns in this country, then we're going to overwhelm America's largest cities.
Not only that, this issue has the ability to turn politics on its head, even just within the Democratic Party. And we see that happening right now in New York City, at least I see it. So this has to be a combined federal, state, and local effort. But principally, it's the responsibility of the federal government, in my view. Mr. Mayor, let me switch subjects on you a little bit. You were a police officer for 20 years. You were arrested as a boy and the victim of police brutality. How do those experiences shape your view of public safety and your responsibility for ensuring the safety of New Yorkers?
It's the uniqueness of my journey and the totality of all of those experiences that I bring into City Hall as the mayor of the city with one of the largest police departments on the globe. Understanding that there's a numerical minority, they are extremely abusive, in policing. And just as we have bad people in every segment of our society, you're going to have it in law enforcement. Let's be clear on that. But what I've learned is to properly identify them and root them out immediately and come up with clear expectations of the level of professionalism you want from law enforcement. But along that journey of being abused, I've watched how many friends and loved ones died to the victims of violence. And I always bring both those perspectives to my approach of public safety, which I believe is a prerequisite to prosperity, public safety, and justice. And we must make sure that we fight crime without harming everyday New Yorkers and their constitutional rights. And that's the balance that we brought here to the city. Our city must be safe. The overproliferation of guns being in the hands of young people who are not finding alternatives, is important to me. And that's why we focus on summer youth employment, 100,000 jobs, the first time in history. We focus on our Summer Rising program, 110,000 young people that were able to be in school over the summer months all year round. Our summer safety plan, how we're going after those who are dealing with mental health illnesses so that they get the support that they deserve. And so what I bring is a holistic approach, an upstream model and not a downstream model of we need to prevent crime instead of always trying to respond downstream when it actually has taken place. I mean, we're doing it. We're putting money where our mouths are. We put $86 million in violence intervention programs because we know we have to prevent violence instead of always reacting to it.
You said something in 1999, I think this is while you were still in law enforcement, that struck me. Quote, "Lying is at the root of our training. At the academy, recruits are told that they should not see black or brown people as different, but we all do. We all know that the majority of people arrested for predatory crimes are African American. We didn't create that scenario, but we have to police in that scenario. So we need to be honest and talk about it." End quote from Eric Adams, 1999. What prompted you to say that, sir?
I recall the scenario like it was yesterday. A young man was being interviewed to go into one of our specialized units, and they gave him a scenario that he had to respond to of a shooting. And they said, "Give us your response by using your radio call." And that's all we gave him. There was a shooting. You have to respond to it and have other units meet you at the location. He said, "Central, this is officer such and such. I have a shooting. Suspect is a male, black, 30 years old, wearing such and such, such and such." Once he finished, we said, "We never gave you a race." He automatically felt as though if it was a perp that was involved with the shooting, the perpetrator involved with the shooting, it automatically was a male, black. That showed me that because we respond to crises and crimes and other incidents over and over again of a certain demographics, we have a tendency to believe everyone that fits that demographics or that profile is a perpetrator or a person that's committed a crime. And that has been taught from the academic level. And we have to start to be honest about what we are teaching and how we are teaching. That each scenario we approach, we have to approach it based on what we are seeing and not what we've created in our own image. And many of the young people who went into law enforcement came from communities where they've never witnessed diversity before at all. And many of them were never even employed because we focused on academics to determine if a person was a good police officer instead of life experiences. So you could have gone to school for basket weaving and lived in a monolithic community, and you are now being dropped into a community that is diverse as New York City and told, "Don't come with your own personal biases." And we never trained you in the academy to understand that you do have personal biases. And that was a big mistake.
Right after the terrorist attack by Hamas on the state of Israel, you were a very powerful voice in support of Israel, and you have been. And in remarks you gave, you reminded African Americans of the historic bond between Jews and blacks in this country, particularly during the civil rights movement of the 1960s. We're recording this today on October 30. as we speak, Israel Defense Forces are going into Gaza to go after Hamas. What would you say today to those who are concerned about the plight of innocent Palestinian citizens in the Gaza Strip?
I share their concerns. No innocent life should be the victim of any form of violence. And we need to be clear on that. It doesn't matter if it was an Israeli citizen who was victimized by Hamas's terrible actions. It doesn't matter any war that takes place. We should do everything that's possible not to harm innocent civilians. And I'm clear on that. And in this city where we have a large group here of Muslims as well as Jews, we probably have the largest Jewish population outside of Israel. We have close to 1 million Muslims that live in this city. And there's a lot of passion, a lot of tension, a lot of anger, and a lot of uncertainty. And what we must do as a whole, we must understand that what plays out on the stage of the international conflicts and communities, it is carried out on the streets of New York City. And as the mayor, I wanted to be very clear of not only the long African-American relationship with the Jewish community, but the relationship America has with Israel as well. And in no way should we see that as a reason to harm innocent people in anywhere in that region. And I saw innocent people harm on the attacks that took place. And I'm concerned about innocent people being harmed as well as the further steps that we're taking in this war.
What guidance, direction have you given to the police commissioner and the police department for how to cope with the demonstrations that are going on in the city right now?
And that's so important. And I really want to take my hat off to Police Commissioner Caban and the entire team. We've had thousands of individuals on our streets protesting and also raising their voices on both ends of the spectrum. And in some cases, they were across the street from each other. But you're not seeing any incidents of violence. You're not seeing any incidents where people are not obeying the rules and laws. I've been clear to the police commissioner. We have an obligation of allowing people to exercise their constitutional rights. But at the same time, we have an obligation to keep the city safe and not allow any major disruption that's going to prevent our city from moving forward. And the police commissioner has carried out that task, and he has done an amazing job. You know, in this city, diversity is our strength. We are a great city because of that diversity, and we need to understand that. There's a lot of emotions on all sides of this issue, and we must manage those emotions so those emotions do not turn into destruction in our city. And that is the role I have as the mayor of the city of New York.
Mr. Mayor, last question I have for you. You and I are about the same age. You're a little younger than I am, but we're about the same age. I suspect we grew up listening to the same type of music. R&B, do you have any particular favorites that you grew up with?
And I still love them. Not only have I grew up with them, but they're still with me. You know, WBGO is grown folks radio. You know, you
hear okay. Grown. So it sounds like you're a WBGO listener every once in a while.
Yes, I am. Think about those songs and the power of those songs. They told the story. Think of Marvin Gaye, you know, what's going on. He talked about police brutality. He talked about wars. He talked about picket lines. He talked about all those things. You think about my man, Sam Cooke, A Change Is Going to Come. We used to blast that through mom's big stereo at the house all the time, you know, how he felt. So I loved all the music from the Isley Brothers to Marvin Gaye to Al Green. The music gave you your moment at the time, you know, what you were feeling at the time. If I wanted to throw the blue lights on in the basement at those house parties, it was a song for that. If I wanted to inspire me as I was going through a difficult challenge, there was a song for that. Everything from Lean On Me to Aretha, R-E-S-P-E-C-T, Respect Yourself, you know. So all that music is in me. It motivated me, and it allowed me to be the person that I am right now.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know that being mayor of New York, not everybody says thank you for your hard work for us every day. It's a little like being Secretary of Homeland Security, where one failure equals 1,000 successes. But every once in a while, I think you appreciate, as I did when I was in office, every once in a while, somebody comes along and says, thank you so much for everything you're doing to keep us safe. So, Mr. Mayor, thank you for everything you are doing for the city of New York. And I hope we stay in contact, sir.
Yes. And I thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. And I really want New Yorkers to understand these are challenging times. And, you know, it appears as though, you know, people stop me and say, you know, listen, Eric, we know it's hard. Hang in there. I want to be clear. I love my job. I love helping people every day. And I got this. In New York, we got this. We are going to be okay. We've navigated through everything from the Great Depression to the attack on our trade center, through COVID, through economic fallout. But we've come through. We're resilient. We're New Yorkers. And so just as September 11th, we saw the devastation of that attack, we got up September 12th. And we showed the entire globe who we are and what we're made of. And we're going to get up again. You know, it's going to be tough. It's going to be some painful moments. But I'm very clear. I know the city. I love the city. I protected it for 22 years. And I'm going to protect it as the mayor.
Eric Adams, thank you very much for your time. And thank you for this interview on WBGO.